This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coronavirus, Donald Trump, Brexit, Australia burning down. Who has time for climate change by 2030 or disappearing species? We get trapped in the all-encompassing now, but we must still plan for a future Earth, and that is what a team of leading world scientists say in a project called Future Earth's Global Risks Perceptions Initiative. Dr. Diana Liverman is a co-founder of Future Earth. She is an amazing scientist, a lead author in IPCC works from the Nobel Prize-winning 2007 report to the 2018 report on limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. Liverman is co-author of well over 100 refereed journal articles and book chapters. Diana is also a consistent voice for the concerns of women, the poor, and marginalized people. She is Regents Professor at the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. From Tucson, Arizona, Diana Liverman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for talking to me.
Yes, well, let us begin with a conundrum that you raised in your presentation at the Nobel Conference 55 last September. The good news is huge progress in bringing 500 million people out of extreme poverty, reducing hunger, child mortality, the works, really positive gains in recent decades. But that success led to far more greenhouse gas emissions, and that brings unstable weather and an uncertain climate. Diana, can we escape from that trap where more development risks global ruin?
Well, it is a conundrum, and we do know that as millions of people came out of poverty over the last 25 years or so, that they did tend to consume more energy, consume more food, consume more water, and that is one of the reasons that greenhouse gas emissions went up. Although I will say that the poor, as they do come out of poverty, they're not the biggest emitters, of course. That's mostly the wealthy people in the population. But I think that there are ways in which we can bring out people out of poverty without increasing emissions or without increasing environmental impact. And it has to do with finding what I would call low-carbon pathways out of poverty. So if, as people start to have higher incomes, we can provide renewable electricity to them, for example. If we can provide them with healthy, sustainable diets, if we can find ways to reuse and recycle so that they can use water without causing water scarcity, all of those are things that we need to do. And one of the ways that's been captured is with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which seek to eradicate poverty and hunger, but at the same time reduce climate risks and reduce the impact that humanity has on ecosystems.
Diana, why was the group Future Earth founded?
Well, Future Earth is really a consolidation of a number of programs that were operating at the international level. So for several decades, there's been groups of scientists around the world under the International Council for Science coming together with concerns around climate, around biodiversity, around pollution. And Future Earth was created to bring all of those programs together under one umbrella and to link up with other international programs such as the United Nations Environment Program. And so when Future Earth was created, it was designed to be interdisciplinary, to take on some of these great environmental challenges. And one of the things that I particularly respect about the way Future Earth is moving forward is the way that it doesn't just look at natural sciences, it also looks at social sciences. And that's really important because, of course, it's people that are causing many of these environmental problems now, and it's people who are going to solve them.
So you have a larger report just out, Our Future Earth 2020. It's only 53 pages. It's easy to read by the public. I like looking at it. And the first chapter is by the UK science journalist and author Gaia Vince. But the second section comes from a unique survey of global scientists and the biggest risks that they see. Please tell us about that survey.
So that was a survey put together by Maria Ivanova and others. And they surveyed a number of scientists to look at which risks they ranked as most important. And in the responses to that survey, there were like five environmental and social risks that really emerged from all of the others that people listed. And those were climate change, extreme weather, which we get extreme weather irrespective of how much the climate is changing, and we can come back to that if you want. Biodiversity loss was the third big risk that they identified, and then the food crisis and the water crisis. So those five risks, there were just many, many of the more than 200 scientists that responded who really saw these five risks as the critical and urgent ones that we need to face. But the other point that many of the respondents made is that these risks are interacting. So, of course, the food crisis is partly caused by climate change. The biodiversity loss is partly caused by expansion of agriculture. So all five interact as well, mostly to make the crises worse because of the interactions between them.
Well, our listeners in the U.S. South that are flooded out by extreme rainfall, and certainly in the U.K. where they were just battered by Storm Dennis and record flooding in Wales, they're going to want to know what you were trying to say there about extreme weather and climate change.
So extreme weather is a problem even without global warming, and it's a problem partly because of human vulnerabilities and the way we've expanded our cities and our communities into areas that whenever there's an extreme event, they're going to get hit badly. So if you have more and more people living in floodplains, more and more people living on the coast, then hurricanes and floods are going to be more damaging just because there are more people there and more people who are vulnerable. But, of course, we also know from IPCC reports that climate change, global warming, with more energy in a warmer atmosphere, is likely to create more extreme weather. So a series of IPCC reports have now pointed out that with global warming, we can expect more extreme rainfall and more extreme drought. So it's as if, you know, the oscillation has gotten bigger. So people such as some of my colleagues where I used to work at Oxford are now doing a lot of work on what's called attribution, which is trying to figure out if an extreme weather event is caused by anthropogenic or human-caused climate change. And the way they report this is that there are increased chances of extreme weather because of global warming. So they don't say this event is climate change, but they're able to statistically and robustly show that the chances of this extreme weather are increased by climate change.
Now, previously, business and the news media generally relied on the annual Global Risks Report from the World Economic Forum. How is the Future Earth Survey different from that?
Well, it's done by scientists as opposed to corporate executives, although there are many corporate leaders who are pretty familiar with environmental science now. But one of the things that Future Earth is trying to do, and in writing our reports and doing our surveys, is to make sure that we're using the best scientific evidence to assess risks. And many of the scientists who are involved, like myself, have been involved in the big global scientific assessments, not only on climate change, but also, for example, some of the big global assessments on biodiversity. And in fact, this coming week, there's a big international biodiversity forum where they're going to be focusing on these very serious risks of biodiversity loss and trying to come up with some guidance about what our targets should be for reducing them.
And when you offer top scientists a menu of things to worry about, is there a single issue that tops their concerns? And if so, why?
I think it's climate change now. Almost everybody I work with and every report that comes out sees the climate emergency as the most urgent. And I think it's because, well, let me just say, when I first started studying climate change several decades ago, we were looking at something that would occur in the future. I think what's happened now is we're seeing climate change happening around us. We're seeing the fires in Australia. And we never wanted to see our projections come true, but now we're seeing the impacts of climate change that we had projected were going to happen several decades ago. And I think that's added to both the confidence that climate change is happening. I think the other issues are a sense of urgency. So the IPCC report on limiting warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, that's 2.7 Fahrenheit for those who think that way, that report really pointed out that every little bit of warming matters. So there's a big difference in impacts between 1.5 degrees of warming and 2 degrees of warming. And I think many scientists are now recognizing that if we don't act very soon, then we're going to head for warming that is more than 1.5 degrees, more than 2 degrees, and as high as 3.5 degrees centigrade. And that will have very serious impacts on vulnerable human populations and on ecosystems. So there's a sense of urgency. And I also think there's a sense that there are solutions out there that we're not moving ahead on fast enough.
When I interview scientists on Radio EcoShock, there is a tendency to see their own field as the biggest challenge for the future. I mean, oceanographers emphasize the sea, of course, and foresters talk about the loss of forests, biologists, the loss of species. How do you avoid that pitfall in the new survey?
Well, I think it's probably there, but partially you avoid it by having a broad sample. You don't just interview the oceanographers. But I also want to, in a sense, defend scientists sort of caring most about their own field. It's not just that they've studied that field intensively and are absolutely confident about what they're seeing, but many scientists have been doing field work for decades. I know ecologists and oceanographers who, in addition to their science, they're also feeling, you know, genuinely sad and this great sense of urgency as they go back to their field areas and they've been burned or the species have disappeared. Or in my own case, I do a lot of field work and my students do field work with farmers. And it's really hard to spend time with farmers who are losing their crops and losing their livelihoods. So we often do care about the things that we study because we get, you know, very close to them.
Yes, I sensed that from Charlie Veron, who really named many of the world's corals and studied the reefs for his life and now has to chronicle the demise of the reefs, the Great Barrier Reef outside of Australia. I do notice that in the worry ranking by 222 leading scientists from 52 countries, an economic crash caused by a pandemic did not make it into the top five concerns. Maybe we will be blindsided by other unforeseen risks. What do you think, Diana Liverman?
Well, I think that's certainly a possibility. And it's also that the risk of epidemics interacts with some of these environmental risks. So, for example, in the report that Future Earth just produced, there's a section on health and climate change, which talks about some of the interactions between climate change and vector-borne diseases, but also there are concerns that some of the viruses that are coming from in tropical regions are emerging because we're cutting down the forest. So there are some intersections. But, I mean, I don't think that every scientist thinks that environment is the greatest risk in the short term. I think with many of these issues, although we're seeing an immediate crisis, the concern is for future generations. But of course, you know, economic collapse, epidemics, those are of great concern and can happen in an unpredictable way. But they will intersect with this sort of chronic degradation of the global environment. And it comes to this issue of vulnerability. I mean, if you have a lot of people who are sick, they're also going to be the people who are most vulnerable to climate change and extreme weather, who would be most vulnerable if food prices go up, would be vulnerable if water is more scarce.
So in the new Future Earth survey, scientists thought climate change, extreme weather, biodiversity loss, and water crises were most likely to occur, but not a food crisis, not as likely. Why do you think that is?
Well, food did emerge as one of the risks that was identified. But I think that, first of all, we can see quite a lot of solutions to our food crisis. I mean, one of the biggest ones is the amount of food waste. I mean, in the U.S., we waste more than a third of the food that's produced. If we reduce food waste, that would help a lot. There's also the solution, of course, which is being recommended, to move to more plant-based diets. And if one did that, there would be a lot more food available. And the other thing I would say, based on my own field work, is farmers are incredibly adaptable. They will respond, if they can, to drought, to extreme weather, to economic crises, and try to produce food. And one of the things that social scientists and development researchers will often say is that the problem isn't the amount of food, it's the distribution of food. And so if we can redistribute food, if we can reduce food waste, that crisis has some pretty immediate solutions that we can work on.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest from the University of Arizona is the well-known scientist, Diana Liverman. We're talking about how world scientists rank the risks we face in future Earth. We can all list major challenges to this civilization, if not to human survival itself, but these scientists add another dimension. Very different crises can feed back into other risks. As Diana has already told us, could you give us another example of how these feedbacks are worrying scientists, Diana?
You were asking me about feedbacks between environmental crises. And the point I wanted to make is, yes, there are feedbacks between crises. So, for example, climate change is one of the factors that is contributing to biodiversity loss. And if we take forests as part of biodiversity loss, then the loss of forests is contributing to climate change because they're not taking up CO2, and often they're being lost to burning, and that's putting carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So climate and biodiversity are very interactive. But I also wanted to mention the sort of feedbacks within each of the crises and the concern, for example, that as the planet warms, then there are feedbacks, like as the land in the Arctic melts and they lose frozen ground, then you get more methane, which is a gas that is also a greenhouse gas being emitted. Or as you get climate change, that's going to dry out the Amazon and you'll lose the trees there, and that could lead to a sort of feedback cycle of droughts. So there are feedbacks both between the environmental crises and of a crisis on itself.
Where does this survey of scientists go from here, Diana, once the short news attention has ended?
Well, I think that there's a drumbeat of scientific assessments that are underway right now. So we're about halfway through the next report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It'll come out in 2021. And there are hundreds of scientists right now assessing all of the latest research to see what is the latest we're finding on climate change and its impacts and the solution to it. And then at the same time, we have the group of ecologists and biodiversity scientists meeting, making research on this a priority, producing reports. And then Future Earth itself is supporting research and supporting networks that are addressing a number of issues. I think one of the things that's happening is people trying to focus on solutions. So whether it's the solutions to the biodiversity crisis in terms of protection and restoration of ecosystems, or whether it's looking at the solutions that we need to the climate crisis that a lot of scientists now are, and new groups of scientists are coming in with this strong focus on we need to find solutions. What research do we need? What evidence do we need for those solutions? So just because one report comes out, you know, scientists are doing research all the time, and many of them are focusing on these crisis issues and the solutions to them.
In 2019, you participated in a paper about transforming national meteorological and hydrological services into national climate service centers. I like the sounds of that. What is the vision there?
Well, what this is trying to do is that most countries, of course, have had weather services for a long time that do weather prediction and forecasting. And this is to add a climate dimension because, of course, climate is a shift in the average of the weather rather than any individual weather event. So the idea behind climate services is to either add a component to a weather service or create a separate climate service where stakeholders, farmers, water managers can go to get information about what is happening to the climate, but also things like who's vulnerable. So we've done this for disaster response for many decades, but now we're actually trying to create systems where people can get information about how the climate is changing now, how it might change into the future, and also strategies for adapting to those climate changes. So I've been involved in projects in the Caribbean. I've been talking to people in Guatemala and also in a number of European countries. They're establishing climate services to help people respond to ongoing climate change.
Well, it would be wonderful to see the TV weatherman go that extra step further and say, well, yes, it's record hot, and that's another sign of climate change. They seem to leave that last part of it out.
Well, some do. There was a study a few years ago that suggested that some of the meteorologists, TV meteorologists, were a bit skeptical about climate change. But I think that's changing with the observations of what's happening. And my local weather people do mention climate change when it's relevant, and they do come to events where we're talking about climate change. So I do think that the meteorological community is now pretty much on board with climate change being a problem and something that their listeners and users want to hear about.
And you were also co-author of a 2019 report from the IPCC, a task force on gender. Could you give us just a couple of snapshots from that?
Oh, yes. So as your listeners, I'm sure, know, there's been questions and concerns about women in science and the extent to which they've experienced barriers or discrimination. And we still don't have an equal balance of men and women in science, even though girls often do better than young men in science in their early years. So one of the things that a group of us decided to do was to take a group of the world's leading climate scientists, who would be many of those who contribute to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and survey both men and women to see whether they felt that there were problems within the IPCC. And we found that, yes, a number of the women who responded felt as though they hadn't been heard, that they faced barriers because they were caring for children or for elderly parents, that there was still not a good balance of men and women. So the first IPCC report in 1990, there were more than 100 men and only 3 women who were authors. And that's improved over time. Now about a third of the IPCC authors are women. But both men and women feel as though there is opportunity for even further balance. And one of the exciting results of the report that we wrote on gender balance in IPCC is that the IPCC is now adopting a gender and inclusion policy, which includes, for example, sensitivity training as part of meetings and making sure that the leadership of IPCC is balanced between men and women. But I will say that the majority of women have not felt as though they've had problems in the IPCC. They feel as though the problems and barriers they've encountered have been more generally in their career and a part of the sort of more general problems that we find in science.
Diana Liverman, your PhD dissertation at the University of California was titled "The Use of a Simulation Model in Assessing the Impacts of Climate on the World Food System." Now, today that would not be remarkable, but that was 1984. What got you on this essential track so early?
Boy, you've really done your research into my deep career history. So I got interested in that because when I was a graduate student, I was very concerned about drought and its impact on the poor in places like Africa and Latin America and how they became vulnerable. And then I started hearing about climate change, and I had an amazing chance to do a research fellowship at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is in Boulder, Colorado. And when I went to NCAR, people were just starting to talk about climate change, and I was very influenced by a guy called Steve Schneider, who is a very famous climatologist, very inspiring. Unfortunately, he died too soon. But Steve got me interested, and he said, well, if you're interested in the link between drought and hunger, why don't you take a look at some of these projections of climate change? And that is what I decided to do. And there was a group of us who were students there in the early 80s, and everybody's gone on pretty much to a career looking at climate change. But at that point, hardly anybody was interested in what we were doing. And it's sort of amazing now to be living in a world where so many people are concerned and there are so many researchers looking at the issue.
Should scientists feel obligated to always try to give us optimism along with the bad news? What do you think?
Well, I'm a teacher as well as a researcher, and I teach large undergraduate courses at the University of Arizona. I love teaching. And a few years ago, I heard that some of my students were calling my intro course Environmental Depression 101 instead of Environmental Conservation. And I realized I can't keep teaching these young people that, you know, we're heading for the apocalypse. So I try very hard now to include hope. Not sort of false hope, but real examples of solutions in all of my lectures. And in terms of my research, there are signs of hope. There are changing attitudes. There are changing technologies. There are changing policies that are moving us in the right direction most of the time. But it's really in my teaching that I feel an obligation to try to give my students hope for the future and not feel sort of depressed and anxious about where they're going.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners?
Well, I think one thing I would say is I don't want people to panic. One of the things that I felt bad about after the IPCC report came out was, you know, people contacting me and saying, is it too late? Is the world going to collapse in 12 years? Is that what the IPCC said? And I want people to know that it's a serious problem and we need to act. But I don't think people need to feel personally as though things are going to come to an end and that they should be worrying about the future of their children unnecessarily. I think people have to act. They have to act fast and they have to act calmly, but they shouldn't give up hope.
We have been speaking with Dr. Diana Liverman, professor of geography at the University of Arizona and co-founder of Future Earth. You can find links to Our Future on Earth 2020 and the new survey of world scientists at futureearth.org. As always, I'll put detailed links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Diana, thank you so much for sharing your time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Here is a headline that breaks through the noise. One-third of plant and animal species could be gone in 50 years. Surely that can't be true. A mass extinction in one lifetime? Let's dig into the science behind the headline with an expert author in this study. John J. Weens is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. Weens is a reviewer for over 100 scientific journals. He gives presentations all over the world. He is author, co-author, or contributor to almost 200 scientific papers or chapters, and he previously worked with the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. John's specialty is amphibians. From Tucson, Arizona, Dr. Weens, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Well, your new paper was published in the top-tier journal, The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And let's start with a surprise to me, and perhaps to other scientists. It isn't the gradual year-by-year warming that we see on the charts that kills off the local species. Extreme heat events are the key. Can you explain that to us?
Well, that's not entirely true. It's potentially year-to-year, gradual year-to-year warming, but the point is that it's in the hottest summer temperatures and not in the annual mean temperatures.
Okay, so are you talking about during a heat wave we would see more animals dying off?
It doesn't have to necessarily be a heat wave, but just the hottest temperatures in summer are the main driver.
Okay, because we have seen videos of bats dropping out of trees during Australia's record heat, and we hear about birds falling out of a hot sky.
No, that totally makes sense, yeah.
Okay, so that can happen. But what about mammals? I mean, we regulate our body temperature. What happens to the so-called cold-blooded species, like the lizards you study, when the outside temperature gets way too hot?
Well, they would tend to hunker down. They tend to not be out when it's at its hottest. And that's actually true for a lot of animals.
And how do we know that maximum temperatures were the key to local extinctions rather than things like increased rainfall or maybe an early spring bringing out the insects before the birds arrive?
Sure, that's a great question. So what we did in this study was to take data from lots of previous studies that looked at the distribution of species over time. And so we looked at data from 581 sites all around the world and also 538 species. And what we specifically looked at is sites where species had gone locally extinct. That means they're not found at that site anymore. And what my grad student, Christian Roman Palacios, who's the lead author of the paper, what he did was to get climatic data for the time of the initial survey of the site, of each site, and when it was resurveyed decades later. And from that, he was able to figure out which climatic variables predict whether a site has local extinctions or not. And he looked at 19 different climatic variables, and the strong pattern that he got was that extinctions were most likely at sites where there had been a larger increase in those maximum temperatures of the year, the hottest summer temperatures.
And do we know what the mechanisms are within plants and insects and animals that causes them to die in such numbers, right up to 95% death rates? I mean, how do they die?
And there could be a lot of different things going on. So, for example, we published a paper about 7 years ago that looked at what was driving species declines and extinctions from climate change. And a lot of times it's species interactions. So it doesn't just have to be that they hit their physiological limits and just drop down and die, but it could actually be things like reduced food or increased disease, things like that.
You did not include marine species in this study.
That's right. I didn't, but we did in an earlier study about 4 years ago. I did look at the patterns of local extinction in marine and terrestrial species and found that they are pretty similar.
And what about human incursion, like ripping down rainforests for palm oil plantations or building suburbs out into the wildlands? Isn't that a major factor driving extinction of other species?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, but that's not what we looked at. We basically looked at what was happening in intact habitats. And in some ways, this is even worse, right? Because we found that even if you keep the habitats intact, you still could get, you know, a loss of up to 30% of the species, right, under an extreme warming scenario. But if you add in habitat destruction, cutting down the rainforest, burning down the rainforest, that's, you know, that by itself could be two-thirds of all species on Earth. Some people have estimated, right? So most of Earth's biodiversity is in tropical rainforests. And so just chopping those down is catastrophic in and of itself.
And your team looks at two possible ways animals, bugs, and plants try to survive climate change. And one way is finding a niche, and that's a key concept throughout your paper. But what is a niche?
for the purposes of our paper, it's simply the temperature and precipitation conditions where they can and do live. So when we talk about a niche shift, we talk about comparing the conditions where they used to live in the initial survey and then new conditions where they're able to survive. So if they're not able to survive the new conditions, they go locally extinct. If they are able to survive, we call that a niche shift.
And you have another new paper in 2019 suggesting that non-native species might be able to make those niche shifts faster, and maybe that would replace some local species that need that space.
Yeah, I think kind of the main thing that I actually got out of that paper is just that species are capable of these really extraordinary niche shifts. And in the case of the non-native species, a lot of them are instantaneous. So basically, it's like throwing a species from the woodlands of eastern North America into the desert, and it survives. And that actually literally happens sometimes. And so that sort of explains why, in some cases, you know, species are able to tolerate some pretty impressive increases in temperature. And it may not even be evolutionary. It just means they had the ability to tolerate these warmer temperatures all along. So that explains some of the patterns.
Can humans in our natural resource planning protect niches to reduce extinction even on a hotter planet?
Well, we're talking about climatic niches. I mean, really, the main way to do that is to reduce global warming.
Right. That makes sense. Okay. So there are two other well-known responses to climate change we expect many species to take if they can. And one is to head towards the poles, as various birds and fish are already doing. But most species are kind of limited to a second option, which is heading further up the mountains to find cooler spots. Can moving to a higher elevation work for many of the species that you included in your study?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And what we found is that for a lot of the species that did move, about half of them seemed to move too slowly to be able to, you know, survive climate change. But the weird thing is actually out of those 538 species, about two-thirds of them didn't move at all. So it's easy to sort of anthropomorphize and say, oh, the animals should just move up the mountain, but they're not necessarily doing that. In fact, and most of the time, they're not actually doing that. And so our overall conclusion is that, you know, the dispersal doesn't seem to be, based on our data, doesn't seem to be a really important mechanism for preventing local and species-level extinctions.
Well, some things just don't like to leave home, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that may well be part of it. So, like the lizards that I study, many times they just, you know, have their favorite rock pile and they're not going anywhere their whole lives.
Well, since mountainsides are going to be smaller space than the plains below them anyway, wouldn't a rush upwards cause crowding and intense competition for available food sources?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a possibility, and we could potentially be looking at sort of novel combinations of species that, you know, where things work out very badly.
And this whole idea of moving towards the poles, I mean, I recall a study, it's a little fuzzy in my mind, but that some trees can only migrate north a few miles in a decade. So a lot of plants and animals are not going to be able to use that as an option, I presume.
No, you're absolutely right. And we, you know, we focus mainly on this upslope dispersal going up a mountain. And that's, you know, you can do that much more quickly, right? So moving north in latitude, trying to get cooler that way, I think is much more difficult because it involves much larger distances.
Did you find that more species will go extinct in the tropics? And if so, is that just because there are more species there to begin with? Or is there an added driver about climate change at various latitudes?
So we looked at that, and depending on the climate projections that we looked at, species-level extinctions were anywhere from 2 to 4 times more likely in the tropics than they were in the temperate zone. And what drives that isn't the greater number of species in the tropics. What it is a very interesting property of tropical climates, and that is that they have much lower temperature seasonality. And so this is really easy to get your mind around. So imagine somewhere in the temperate zone, say Denver, Colorado, for example, where I grew up, it gets really hot in the summertime and it gets really cold in the wintertime. Now think about somewhere in the tropics, like a middle elevation in the Andes, like the town of Armenia, where Chris John grew up in Colombia. That has sort of a mild, warm temperatures all year long. And so species in the tropics are adapted to a limited range of temperatures. So even a small increase is more likely to kill them.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith here with Dr. John Weins from the University of Arizona. We're talking about his latest paper, Recent Responses to Climate Change Reveal the Drivers of Species Extinction and Survival, and the results are pretty shocking. So, John, you began your study by analyzing species that have already gone extinct. What makes you think past extinction will be a reliable guide for the future, especially when the climate is likely shifting faster than at any time in recent Earth history?
Well, just to clarify, we didn't actually look at species that have gone entirely extinct. So we looked at the pattern of local extinction, and so we use that those patterns to identify which variables are most important for causing local extinctions. And then we also can analyze the specific temperatures that basically cause these local extinctions to happen. So we figure out how much heat they can take. And so we use that information and we combine that with their dispersal rates. I think we can get a relatively precise estimates of how much extinction there may be in the future.
I guess my problem is there have been a number of scientific studies that have been sort of based on the past. And then when we see what actually happens, whether it's sea ice disappearing or temperatures in Antarctica, things are happening much faster and worse than we expected.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. And so we tried to look at, you know, a couple of different projections of what future climates will look like. And so I kind of think of this as a choose-your-own-adventure, right? So do we want to lose 16% of the species on Earth or 30% of the species on Earth? And basically, it's up to us. It's up to, you know, it depends on what sort of how much climate's going to warm. So our study, it's not the role of our study to determine how much climate change there's going to be. What we're trying to estimate is, given different amounts of climate change that's happened, how many species are we going to lose?
Okay, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has proposed in their reports two different pathways. One's called RCP 4.5, and the other, which is the one we're on right now, is RCP 8.5. Did you find a big difference in extinctions if we take that sort of intermediate pathway where we try and pull in carbon and we do better, or the worst one where we don't do anything about this?
Yeah, that's actually the main results of the study is under the RCP of 4.5, we project sort of a mean estimate of 16% species loss. And under RCP 8.5, we project 30% species loss. And those are sort of mean. So they can be under different, you know, individual projections. For example, that could actually be as high as 55%. But the mean projection under RCP 8.5 is 30% species.
By 2070.
By 2070.
Right. So reading your paper, I got the impression that there's a breaking point for these living things, somewhere over a warming of 2.8 degrees C, which we do expect by 2070 under our current path. So a lot of things survive up to a point and then die off. Is that how you think it will work?
Yeah, that's particularly for local populations. So we found that with an increase of 0.5 degrees Celsius in hottest summer temperatures, about 50% of the populations that reached that temperature went locally extinct. And then over the 2.8, that's where 95% of the populations that experienced that increase went locally extinct. So that's the 2.8 is the really bad one.
I guess that we have to understand that our whole fixation, I would call it, with global mean temperature is not going to tell us what we need to know about extinctions from this paper.
Yeah, in particular, that's a really great question. So in particular, what we find was that the annual mean temperatures are actually a pretty bad predictor of where you're going to get local extinctions. We actually found local extinctions were occurring more in places that had a smaller increase in mean annual temperatures, but they had a larger increase in maximum summer temperatures.
Another of your 2019 papers explores the options for a mountain lizard, I would call it. What is the story there? Tell us about your friend and what you found.
Yeah, so that's kind of more of an ancient climate change story. So this is looking at the sky islands that we have here around Tucson. So we actually have about 31 mountain ranges where it has this really nice Madrean oak pine woodland. And they're isolated in these 31 different mountain ranges that are called sky islands. So we see it's a sky island or a mountain island surrounded by desert seas. But this, we know that in the past, this species was continuously distributed. You know, so it was at one point occurred in the lowlands, and has since become isolated. And so what we wanted to test is, was it isolated by past climate change? So We looked at a lot of different things. We looked at their physiological variables, and we looked at their evolutionary relationships amongst the different mountain ranges, and we even looked at their interactions with another species. And from that study, we inferred that, yes, they probably were widespread in the past and were driven locally extinct in the lowlands by climate change, and that's why they're isolated in these sky islands today.
To be clear, you do not claim that your new paper is an all-encompassing global study, but even in the 538 species chosen, you found a couple of misconceptions in science?
The two main things are is that we found that the global mean annual temperatures were not a very good predictor of extinction. That was one thing. And then the other thing was the importance of knit shifts versus dispersal. So we found that the knit shifts seem to be much more important for allowing species to survive climate change than dispersal. Those were the two main things.
John Weens, is it possible to expand your methods to the countless creatures all over the globe and to calculate a kind of global extinction prediction for this century?
You know, our paper is sort of a rough attempt at that, and our sampling of species we think is sort of broadly representative. So there's lots of tropical insects, and there's a smaller number of plants and a smaller number of vertebrates. But definitely what's needed in the future is, I think, more studies that take this approach, but with lots more sampling of all these groups of plants and animals all over the world based on these surveys over time.
But we are going to get extinctions, local extinctions, and possibly complete extinctions of animals and plants and insects during the lifetimes of many of our listeners.
Absolutely. I mean, these local extinctions are already really widespread. So out of the 538 species that we looked at, 44% of them already had local extinctions. And in 2016, I published this paper with a somewhat larger sampling of species that included marine and freshwater species also, and that was 47% local extinction. So, and this is all already happening.
Would it be correct to say that your research shows that the biggest single threat to the rich tapestry of life on this planet comes directly from climate change?
I wouldn't say that necessarily. I still think that I would say that destruction of the tropical rainforests is really the one thing that could wipe out the largest number of species. And some people have estimated that, you know, if we lose all or most of our tropical rainforests, that's 2/3 of all the species on Earth right there. But the really bad thing about climate change is, you know, if we imagine, so, okay, we need to protect these remaining patches of habitat, right? And that's a great thing. But the problem with climate change is it's really hard to protect things. You know, it's really hard to protect things from climate change, right? So you can, you know, potentially protect a patch of forest from being chopped down, but it's really hard to protect that patch from climate change.
Right. It could just burn down while we're saving it as a national park. And this has already happened in many places of the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that the burning of the tropical rainforest is just like the worst thing. And what's also bad about that is also that it's also going to accelerate climate change. Because those plants, the tropical rainforest is, you know, normally has the potential to suck up carbon from the atmosphere and reduce global warming. But if we just chop down the forests or burn them down, it's just going to increase the rate of global warming.
You know, I got to tell you, I talked to a lot of scientists with some pretty scary news, but the idea of losing almost a third of all the creatures on Earth within 50 years, it was almost too horrible to think about. I thought about not calling you, but what kind of reaction are you getting in the media and from other scientists?
It tends to be, very, there's been reports of this as a nightmare study, and sometimes it's a little, you know, it's a little overblown to call it 50%. That's not necessarily, that's kind of a more extreme scenario. But other people have called it a not so grim story. And part of the reason why is that, you know, there are these different scenarios, right? And the uncertainty in our estimates come mostly from, you know, what people are going to do in the future. So, you know, if we wanted to stick to the Paris Agreement, for example, this could be 16%. So we could cut that, you know, 30% in half, more or less. So I think what happens next is up to us, up to humans, and, you know, whether we want to live in a dramatically impoverished world in terms of global biodiversity is up to us.
Now, you study frogs and lizards and snakes quite a bit, among other things, and these aren't things that anybody grows in farms and few people eat them, and they're not really popular pets. We don't even think they're that good looking. So,
well, they're kind of popular pets.
Can you make a case to us as why we should really care if the amphibians go extinct?
Well, I mean, they already are going extinct. People do keep them as pets. Actually, a lot of people do eat them. But, I mean, so there's a couple of issues there. You know, one is whether it's morally justified for us just to wipe out other species. And, you know, once you say, oh, it's okay to wipe other species off the planet, I mean, it's not a far step to say, well, what about other groups of people? You know, it's where exactly do you draw the line? I mean, you know, just, you know, sort of wiping out the rest of life is a slippery slope, I think. Another thing is, you know, this study that just came out, it's not focused on amphibians and reptiles. Most of the things are tropical insects and plants and lots of birds. And, you know, if there's also been a lot of attention focused on bees, for example. I mean, if we lose the pollinators, then we lose a lot of plants. If we lose a lot of plants, that will affect people.
Absolutely. What are you working on next?
So one of the things, there's lots of kind of ways to take this research in the future, and one of those is to kind of figure out more about the rhyme and reason of who's surviving and who's not. Another really important thing to figure out, as you kind of mentioned before, is to figure out exactly what's happening in these populations that are going locally extinct. So, you know, we sort of had this review paper from several years ago saying it's species interactions, but really we'd like to know a lot more about what exactly is causing these populations to wink out.
We've been speaking with Dr. John J. Weens. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. His latest paper is Recent Responses to Climate Change Reveal the Drivers of Species Extinction and Survival. And you can find out more from the Weens Lab, so that's WIENSLab.com, or in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Professor Weens, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks so much. You asked really a lot of great questions, and it's great. You really did your homework, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I'm Alex Smith reporting. The Northern Hemisphere just experienced its warmest winter ever recorded. The lower 48 states of the U.S. were 3 degrees C higher than the average for the 20th century. That is 5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Europe saw its hottest January ever, 3.1 degrees C warmer than the average. It was an astounding 5 degrees C warmer across most of Russia, Scandinavia, and eastern Canada. This is 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average. Astounding. Despite predictions of a colder winter by some commercial forecasting companies, the jet stream was pulled north, keeping the cold near the pole this year. It may result in more winter sea ice, but plants are coming up early in America and Europe. Use of winter heating oil and gas in the U.S. is way down, adding to the glut of energy and lower prices. The 4 warmest Januaries ever recorded all happened over the last 4 years. Planet Earth is warming, even in winter. Meanwhile, it's been beach weather in Antarctica. Antarctica logs the hottest temperature on record with a reading of 18.3 degrees C, says the Guardian headline, February 7th. That is about 65 degrees Fahrenheit on a continent which seldom rises above freezing. The temperature on the Antarctic Peninsula was about the same as in Los Angeles that day. Here's another headline from NASA. Antarctica melts under its hottest days on record. But that is just the surface, where instant ponds of water are appearing. They can see them from the satellites. Down below, warmer ocean waters are eating away at the bottoms of the glaciers. That hidden warming will lead to rising seas faster than expected. This development is stunning scientists who study those glaciers. You can get a full update from climate scientist Paul Beckwith on YouTube. He has 3 new videos out to explain what is happening at the South Pole. Find links at paulbeckwith.net or in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Let's talk about why I think we will have a food crisis during this decade. I disagree with the scientists who do not see a food crisis as likely in the near term, as explained by our guest Diana Liverman. There have been other recent papers to tell you about which warn crop failures can occur simultaneously in several parts of the world. For example, at the December 2019 meeting of the American Geophysical Union, Nathan Steiger from Columbia's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory revealed mega droughts occurred repeatedly in western North America during the medieval period. These dwarfed any droughts observed during the 19th and 20th centuries. At least one of those droughts in California developed at the same time as a massive drought in South America. There appears to be a link between conditions causing big droughts on both continents. Scientist Mingfang Ting, quoted here from a Columbia press release, says, projects that warming temperatures will lead to reduced precipitation plus increased evaporation of soil moisture in the U.S. Midwest Corn Belt, a climatic double whammy. Much of the precipitation that previously reached this region will instead be exported northward to the currently drier Great Plains, he says. In a related study, Dr. Puma reports that warmer temperatures will increase the likelihood of events similar to the 1930s Dust Bowl, an event briefly mirrored in the powerful 2012 to 2013 U.S. drought. He projects that crop losses could greatly exceed 2012-2013, and that shocks could cascade through the world food system. That was from a press release from Columbia University last December. Remember, too, my Radio EcoShock interview in May 2019 with Swiss scientist Martha Vogel. She expects more concurrent heat waves appearing on multiple continents, like the 2010 monster that caused Russia to stop exporting wheat. Her new research suggests we are entering an age where multiple food failures could occur, killing people and crops. Here is the way the lead author, Dr. Kai Kornhuber from Oxford and Columbia, put it in a press release. Co-occurring heat waves will become more severe in the coming decades if greenhouse gases are not mitigated. In an interconnected world, this can lead to food price spikes and have impacts on food availability, even in remote regions not directly affected by heat waves. We have a 20-fold increase in the risk of simultaneous heat waves in major crop-producing regions when these global-scale wind patterns are in place. Until now, this was an underexplored vulnerability in the food system. We have found that during these events, there actually is a global structure in an otherwise quite chaotic circulation. The bell can ring in multiple regions at once, and the impacts of those specific interconnections were not quantified previously. And that quote is from Dr. Kai Kornhuber. But on the good news side, the world reached a new record for cereal production in 2019, and this year's prospects look good so far, according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Even with democracy under attack and this new disease raging, this could be a signal to make your relationships good, to love life around you, and to get active. Thanks for listening. I'm Alex Smith.